Lights.
Camera.
Philosophy.
It's the fifth mostly annual Dionysus Awards
for the most philosophically compelling movies of 2017.
And the nominees are...
For the most searing examination of the human tendency to denigrate the other.
Get Out.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
For the most philosophically absurdist and cinematically transgressive film...
Mother.
Have kids.
Then you'll be creating something together. This is all just... setting.
For the richest investigation of the drivers of history...
The Darkest Hour.
You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
Join us as we celebrate movies that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
The 2018 Dionysus Awards.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, it's the fifth mostly annual Dionysus Awards show.
The Dionysus Awards are presented to the most philosophically interesting movies of the past year.
We'll talk to philosophers, film critics, and listeners like you to find out what movies in 2017 challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
So this isn't your average awards show here. We're not going to tell you what high fashion designer made the outfits that we're wearing today.
Yes, we're not about glitz and glitter, but about thought and reason and how they're embodied in the movies, John.
And we're also going to show you our reasons and our thinking process. We're going to debate our way to thinking which movies should win an award.
And we're also going to take nominations from the floor, and they too are going to have to justify their choices.
Of course, we can't really talk about the movies of 2017 without talking about the movie industry in 2017, which was itself a big story and not for reasons that the industry can be proud of.
Yeah, our society is changing radically in response to the Me Too movement. But what about Hollywood? Has anything changed for women in Hollywood, either on the big screen itself or behind the camera? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to find out.
There's a lot of reasons to feel like this year, movies by and about women finally broke out big time.
Something inside me has always been there.
The top three highest grossing movies were fronted by women. There was Star Wars The Last Jedi.
But now it's awake. And I need help.
Beauty and the Beast.
I'm not ready to have children.
Maybe you haven't met the right man.
It's a small village, Gaston. I've met them all.
And Wonder Woman.
Is this what people do when there are no wars to fight?
There were also huge hits like Girls Trip, Lady Bird, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and I, Tonya.
America, they want someone to love, but they want someone to hate.
But if this is the beginning of the end of male hegemony in Hollywood, we've got a long way to go. Especially when it comes to who's making the films.
It's wild that we're having this battle.
Here's Allison Wilmore, critic with BuzzFeed News.
But, you know, when you look at the numbers, they're really just shocking still.
Those numbers, only 7% of the 1,100 top grossing movies last year were directed by women.
You know, Greta Gerwig is nominated for an Oscar for Best Director this year. And she's only the fifth woman to ever be nominated for Best Director. There's only been one winner, you know, and that's over decades and decades.
This isn't the first time that the top three highest-grossing films were female-fronted. It's happened before. In 1956. Melissa Silverstein is the publisher of the website Women and Hollywood. She says female representation in movies didn't used to be such a problem until the 1970s. The industry exploded, which meant a lot more money was at stake. Producers became more cautious. Movies became a lot more formulaic.
That was when the whole movie industry shifted. And that was when we saw, really, the huge decline in women.
Add to that the fact that the market is now global.
The way that they've thought about international dollars is men, very few words, lots of action.
You talking to me?
And you get a lot of very conservative bets about what kinds of movies people like. Silverstein says people want what they're familiar with, but we can broaden the familiar.
If you're fed a diet for so long, like a McDonald's diet, and that's what you've been fed, you become addicted to it.
Allison Wilmore says we need to diversify the industry's shot callers who decide which movies to fund. Right now, it's a limited group of white men.
And that's really, I think, what it comes down to, is that if you look at a movie and you don't see commercial potential in it because it doesn't speak to you personally, that doesn't mean it's not going to speak to other people.
So there are plenty of movies made by and about women that just don't get bought and distributed to wide audiences. For example, there's a movie coming out next year called The Tale. It's about a woman dealing with sexual trauma. It was the most talked about movie at Sundance, but it was picked up by HBO.
It's going to bypass this whole world of theaters entirely. And, you know, I think that that is a huge bummer for me as someone who thought it was a very good movie and a really kind of bold movie, both thematically and kind of in terms of aesthetics.
Movies fall through at all stages of the process, and Melissa Silverstein says that puts a lot of pressure on aspiring female directors.
Because there still is such an issue of a lack, every movie is held up to a higher standard, and we really need that to end.
It can feel like there's undue attention on celebrities when women are sexualized and inhibited in all kinds of workplaces. But Allison Wilmore says there's more at stake than just the individuals in the industry. When it comes to movies,
the accrued weight of these images tends to shape how you think of the world. And certainly, like, not being able to see yourself or your point of view reflected on screen ever, and like having one particular point of view be so dominant, has meaning to people.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks so much for that report, Liza. I'm Josh Landy, and I'm here with my Stanford colleague, Ken Taylor, talking about the most philosophically interesting movies of 2017 for our fifth, mostly annual, Dionysus Award show.
So let's get to our first award then, Josh. Now, we've got two nominees for the most searing depiction of humankind's tendency to dehumanize the other. One's a dark, dark horror film, and the other is a very uplifting fairy tale. The two movies, Get Out and The Shape of Water. Let's start with The Shape of Water. What do you think about The Shape of Water?
I just think it's glorious. I mean, so this is a movie about a love affair between a young woman and a swamp creature, which might sound absurd, but it is a fairy tale, and it's extremely, it's gorgeously shot. It's kind of a reversal of The Creature from the Black Lagoon. It's set in 63 or something like that. And it sort of unfolds this to make it into a movie about encounters with otherness.
The thing we keep in there is an affront. Do you know what an affront is, Zelda?
Something offensive.
That's right. And I should know. I dragged that filthy thing out of the river muck in South America all the way here. And along the way, we didn't get to like each other much.
You say it's a fairy tale. It's sort of like a Beauty and the Beast kind of fairy tale,
something
right?
Like that. But yeah, where the beast is benevolent.
Yeah, the beast is not malevolent. That's certainly true. Right. But the beast is treated pretty badly by most people in the movie. Right. And the beast is regarded as, well, it's kind of not clear how they regard the beast. Some regard it as an object of scientific curiosity. Some regard it as a potential weapon.
What happened?
It's an animal, Hofstetler, just keeping it tame.
Oxygen osmosis and dioxide exchange. What the hell have we got here, son?
This creature, sir, it can alternate between two entirely separate breathing mechanisms.
Mud Skipper can do that.
No. Look, you want to put a man in space. He's going to have to endure conditions the human body just wasn't made for. This gives us an edge against the Soviets.
I think that's one of the strengths of the movie, is it presents us, first of all, with a gallery of kinds of otherness.
Yeah.
You have a woman with a disability, you have African-Americans, you have a gay man, all, you know, in the 60s context. And a gallery of responses to otherness, as you were saying, right, all the way from hatred and fear through curiosity and scientific interest to passion, excitement, and love.
Right, right. And the main character, Eliza, is mute and very lonely, seemingly.
Yeah.
Very apart, right? And the beast. Both of these people are kind of singular and apart. And I think that's the kind of the basis of her initial sympathy for
Absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely. And I think the same goes for other characters, who her friend Zelda, who's African-American, and her friend Giles, who's gay. And so you see this same kind of isolation. It's not a complete isolation. Obviously, they have each other.
I have no one. and you are the only person that I can talk to. Now, whatever this thing is, you need it. So, you just tell me what to do.
I like The Shape of Water too, but it has, I think in the end, there's a bit of cowardice, movie-making cowardice to it, because this alien other creature, what does he do that bespeaks his otherness? He looks funny. He lives in a different environment, but the only truly alien thing he does, off-putting thing that he does, is he eats a cat, right? He eats a kitty.
He eats Giles' beloved cat.
He eats a kitty. That's terrible, right? But he doesn't eat a human being. I mean, here would be a courageous movie, a movie that did not try to make you love, recognize yourself in the alien other, but still manage to get you to get beyond the recognition of this other alienness to something. That would be a more courageous movie, because then it wouldn't be so namby-pamby, you know? It wouldn't be so bad.
Look, I'm not sure you're giving The Shape of Water enough credit. I think, yes, it's a fairy tale about otherness, and it has a fairy tale villain with he even wears a black hat, and it has a fairy tale ending. But it knows it's a fairy tale. Why do I say that? Because there's this great scene. Remember that great scene where Giles is watching the television, and something comes on the TV about civil rights?
Oh, dear God, change that awfulness. I do not want to see that. I do not want to see it.
This is escapist, right? This is a refusal to face the reality. Hollywood is bad. But wait a minute. That's this movie. This movie is an escapist fantasy. So this is a movie that has a kind of a guilty conscience about its own leap into fantasy.
I tell you, a much braver movie is Get Out, right? Get Out kind of inverts, in a way, what The Shape of Water does. And it inverts it subversively and powerfully, I think. Because here we've got this interracial relationship, right? And this really cool-seeming couple who have all these moments of intimacy and mutual support. And it sucks us in to approving and cheering. And then it gradually takes all of that away from us. It just unpeels layer by layer. So then they go off.
I mean, it's brilliant because it makes us think that the dramatic question is, are her parents racist?
So how long has this been going on, this thing? How long?
4 months.
4 months?
Mm. 5 months, actually.
She's right. I'm wrong.
Attaboy. Better get used to saying that.
Please, I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. She's right. I'm wrong. See?
Does he have an off button? This is exhausting.
And then there's this twist.
Right.
Right. Which you can kind of see coming.
Oh, wow.
Right.
I didn't.
Kind of, sort of, maybe. The unreflection.
Sure.
You can kind of see
yes.
the subtle cues. And it ends in such a searing note. And there's an alternate ending? I don't know if you know this.
Maybe we could raise the same objection to the movie that was actually released, where, you know, Jordan Peele said that he decided, given the changed political environment.
Oh, that's a lack of courage, too.
Well, so that's what I'm saying, you know? You've got to be even-handed about this,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So, but I think it's really interesting. We've got these two movies, both, in my view, fantastic films. And both of them, interesting, they kind of play with a kind of mixture of realism and fantasy.
Right.
Get Out is an extraordinarily powerful movie.
Yeah.
So there's so many subtleties in
it. And there's some, like, non-subtle things, which are kind of like really broad, kind of comedic almost. They want, these white racists want these black guys because of, I don't know, their generic, their superiority, right? Because they're superior, they're this, they're that. So the white photographer wants Chris's eye.
Right.
He wants his eye. I want that eye. And then he asks, why? I think there's a line in there. Why the black guys? They don't really have a reason.
Why black people?
Who knows? People want to change. Some people want to be stronger, faster, cooler.
Black is in fashion.
But please don't lump me in with that. You know, I could give a shit what color you are.
It's not like there's deep racism here, right? There's a utilitarian otherizing.
Because African Americans are more invisible in today's society, right? So the police aren't going to spend as many resources looking for them when they disappear. So you're right. I think there's a just a convenience that's a holdover from slavery and Jim Crow.
Right, which is, again, a harsh thing,
yes.
Right? So I don't know if you think there's a contest, but I'm on the side of Get Out. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, look, for me, that was the movie of the year. You know, philosophy or no philosophy, Get Out was the movie of the year.
Okay, so we're agreed. The 2017 Dionysus Award for the most searing depiction of humankind's tendency to denigrate the other goes to...
Get Out!
Good to see another brother around here.
Yes, of course it is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our fifth annual Dionysus Award show.
Coming up, we'll take some listener nominations. And Ken and I will announce Dionysus winners in the categories of Richest Investigation of the Drivers of History and Most Cinematically Transgressive and Philosophically Absurdist Film.
Dionysus Award winners plus nominations from the floor when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm Josh Landy, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual Dionysus Awards show.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about the movies of 2017 that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
We're joined by Tim Sika, president of the San Francisco Film Critics Circle. He's also the host, writer, and producer of Celluloid Dreams on KSJS in San Jose, California. And he's got some nominees for the most cinematically transgressive and philosophically absurdist film of the year. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk, Tim.
It's great being back with you guys. I love your show.
Well, thanks a lot. So, look, Tim, you recommended a bunch of movies to us, and we picked out two to talk to you about. And I think these two movies are perhaps the two most, at least two of the most divisive movies of the year in terms of people either love them or hate them. The one movie is Ghost Story, and the other is Mother! Exclamation mark. Let's start with a Ghost Story. Why should we be talking about that movie?
Yeah, for Ghost Story, simple is the word, I think, that best describes this movie. And it takes that description of simple and, I think, raises it to the level of art, which is, for the most part, the movie. I should probably say what it's about. It's about this guy who's played by Casey Affleck who dies in a car accident. And he comes back as a ghost, hovering about all that he has left behind, including specifically his wife, played by Rooney Mara.
Why are you laughing?
I'm so scared.
Why?
I don't know.
Don't be scared.
I think it's a quintessential example of less is more. I think this looks like it might be the lowest budget movie of the year in that most of it takes place in one place and at most a few locations with only a few actors and someone underneath a sheet. That's it.
I'm not sure. I think less is less in the case of this movie. You know, if you love watching paint dry, I think this may well be the movie for you. I mean, 7 minutes of a character eating a pie?
I think it's bold in that regard. I mean, stylistically, I think there are, 10, 12-minute takes of the most simple acts, a person, as you mentioned, eating a pie, a couple making love, somebody grieving, simple acts that by all rights should be boring to watch. Josh, you think they're boring, but in this movie, I couldn't take my eyes off of these scenes, even though really nothing save for the action is happening. So stylistically, I thought it was bold. I thought it was courageous. I thought it took risks. What was interesting to me is that usually movies would explore the person that is alive, their loss, like, you know, what am I going to do? But this sort of took a reverse twist on that and looked at it from the standpoint of a spirit, you know, and then it asks, like, what kind of an impact, if any, do we have on the world that we lived in and that we've participated in? And is that impact felt by anyone or anything when we die? You know, it was about legacy. And it was interesting.
I think it was about a lot of things. I mean, there's hardly any dialogue in it.
And moreover, it's virtually silent.
And moreover, the dialogue that there is in it, there was a little bit before the husband dies, but most of the dialogue that you hear in muffled tones because the ghost is kind of hearing it. And that pie-eating scene, I don't think there's music with that pie. Is there music with that?
Well, why would they have anything to capture your attention, Ken?
Because he is seeing up close his wife's grief at his passing, and that scene captures that grief very powerfully. She comes home from his wake. She brings the pie home from the wake. She starts eating that pie, and she eats more of that pie. She collapses onto the floor, keeping eating the pie. It shows you, like, this is what grief is like. And he's seeing up close the grief of another. I think that's really effective.
In a ghost story, the redeeming feature for me, if there is one, is the moment at which the movie starts playing with time. And I think that becomes interesting. I'm not convinced that the thematic of a ghost wanting to have an influence in the afterlife is particularly original. Of course, you know, we've seen that in many movies. The movie
right,
Ghost,
right, yeah.
And Hamlet.
No,
and,
I mean, and even the symbol, it was a cliche. But
absolutely.
I thought the way all those elements were combined, I thought it was different. What other movie have you seen like a ghost story?
I agree with you, Tim, that this movie is bold. I think it's transgressive. That's why Josh is rejecting it, because it is so transgressive of movie conventions.
Yeah.
Right? But it's transgressive not out of incompetence, but out of bold directorial decision making.
I disagree. I mean, there are plenty of movies. Think of Godard. I mean, there's plenty of movies out there that also, you know, don't fit the Hollywood mold. Absolutely.
Right.
So there are plenty of transgressive movies in that sense, but they're giving you something.
Okay, let's think about another transgressive movie. Mother! Exclamation part. I don't know what you're supposed to do with the exclamation mark. What do you think of that movie?
I loathed this movie when I saw it. I remember being hit up when it was a critic screening. It was before any word had gotten out about the movie. And the publicist said, you know, we need to know your immediate reaction. And I said, nasty, misogynistic, disgusting. What other adjectives do you need?
Look, if you like the spectacle of a woman being psychologically tormented for two straight hours.
He never loved me. You just loved how much I loved you. I gave you everything! You gave it all away.
This movie, Mother, is transgressive as any movie could possibly be. It says, okay, I'm going to tell you this story of this poet who's having trouble writing, and his devoted wife, who is his muse, and they're in this house that she helped rebuild and is restoring, and it's a lovely place, and he's struggling, but he's really famous. People love his work, and innocent-seeming things happen, but those innocent-seeming things are inverted, and they're not innocent, and they're disturbing, and they get more disturbing, and they get more disturbing, and they get more disturbing, and that whole thing is like a journey into darkness. This is the same director who made one of my favorite movies of all time, Requiem for a Dream.
Fantastic
right?
film.
Yeah, and Black Swan, too,
and
which,
Black Swan,
which
right.
also divided people
right.
down the middle.
So this is a really divisive movie. It's an extraordinarily ambitious movie. It's an extraordinarily unrelenting movie, and I think that's high art if you pull that off with
yeah.
skill, and I think this is done with great skill. Are you supposed to take pleasure in it? That would be an odd thing to do, but are you supposed to be somehow gripped by it? Yes, I think you are.
What have you done? I'm so sorry. We're both sorry. I was telling her the story.
It just fell out of my hand.
We'll search and find another one, I promise. Quiet!
Look, I grant you the technical sophistication. Absolutely, it's beautiful. And I grant you absolutely the power of these acting performances. But is it really complex? I don't think so. I think that's my problem, that this is really just a movie on one note. It's, as you said, Ken, it's unrelenting. Mother is just an unrelenting cavalcade of psychological torment inflicted upon the central character. I'm not convinced that this movie does it in a particularly interesting way, to be honest.
What do you think, Tim?
Well, I don't know. You know, to me, the movie played, and this is why I hated it, it played like a whiny rant of a narcissistic artist who felt misunderstood, never acknowledged, and underappreciated, and that everyone was to blame for his shortcomings and failures and feelings of insecurity except the artist himself. And if it were anybody's fault, it was clearly the wives, right? But the filmmaker Darren Aronofsky claimed that the film was a metaphor, and this is what he was going for the destruction of the planet, of the environment, and of Mother Earth.
I do think it's ultimately about a kind of destructiveness, but I think I thought it was about the destructiveness of the artistic impulse, right? I mean, what does his artistic impulse, and he's represented as a great poet, right? And when he finally writes his new poem, it brings everybody to tears, and everybody goes, and all this sort of stuff. And this is this wild party that started as a wake and turns into a party, and then there's killers. It's all crazy stuff in Mother.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine, but the way in which it's manifested in the movie has a real arbitrariness to it and a one-noteness. You know, for me, this is a movie for masochists made by sadists.
He butchered our son.
I know.
You're insane.
Listen to me.
You're insane.
Well, listen to me. You're so sorry. You're truly sorry. Listen, have faith in me. Please, please, we need to forgive them. We need to forgive them. Please.
Maybe we could give Mother a golden philosophical raspberry.
Okay. The 2017 Golden Raspberry for the most ambitious, transgressive, but ultimately failed philosophical movie of the year goes to
Mother!
And this 2017 Dionysus Award, somewhat reluctantly given for the most philosophically ambitious, simple-minded, but transgressive and divisive movie of the year goes to
A Ghost Story.
This shouldn't be so hard.
I really don't want to talk about this anymore tonight, okay?
Well, can we talk about it tomorrow?
Okay, maybe.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're giving out our annual Dionysus Awards for the most philosophically compelling movies of 2017.
Last August, Ken talked to our film blogger Leslie Francis about portrayals of heroism in some of the summer blockbusters. That got us thinking about two movies in particular, Dunkirk and The Darkest Hour, movies that ask the question, who are the real drivers of history, the great leader or the soldier at the front? Leslie Francis joins us again now to help us decide which, if either, of these movies deserves a Dionysus Award. Leslie, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, and it's great to be here.
We're going
to
talk about Dunkirk and The Darkest Hour. Tell Josh and me what you thought of those two movies, and which did you like more?
Well, so they're both exciting. They're both really well-made movies. One is about the heroism of the little guy. One is about the heroism of the big guy. And as adventure movies, they're both fantastic. They're differently fantastic. Dunkirk, how it uses time and visuals is absolutely stunning. The Darkest Hour, how it uses the parliamentary intrigue, the image of Churchill and the little guy in London, that's terrific.
Yeah, that's one of the things that struck me about Dunkirk, that you have three stories happening on three different timelines. So you have an hour in the life of a pilot, you have a day in the life of a small boat owner, and a week in the life of soldiers on the beach. And that's quite nice. I mean, it sort of implies that wars actually happen on different timescales, or the things that are important in wars happen on different timescales.
Oh, that's a really nice observation. I hadn't really thought about that part of Dunkirk. But all those share, all those points of view that you should talk about share that they're not at all from the big global political situation. I mean, I think the word German is pronounced exactly once, right? Because the Dutch guy on the boat, there's a Dutch guy on the boat, and they say, are you a Kraut?
He's a German spy. Don't be daft. Have you noticed he hasn't said a word?
You're daft. Tell him.
Yeah. Tell me, Gibson.
Tell me!
Tell him, for God's sake.
Rossi.
She's with Rossi.
A frog. Bloody frog!
Germany's referred to as the enemy, and the enemy is never named. And moreover, the word Hitler is never uttered, never once. So it's really, really focused on that beach and what's happening on that beach. And it could be any beach in any war at any time.
And it's not just that Dunkirk isn't about Churchill. It's also not about Hitler.
Right.
It's not about the important single individual, whether positive or negative.
Right.
Although, remember that at the very end of Dunkirk, there is the read of the speech from Churchill, which suddenly sets it in the context of what's happening.
Right. It's striking that both movies end with Churchill's speech, with Gary Oldman giving that speech. It's so stirring when he delivers it. And the soldier just quietly reading that speech on a bench.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
And in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender!
Of course, there was a third movie about Churchill last year, as though two weren't enough.
I don't actually think The Darkest Hour just plainly presents Churchill as just an unmixed great man.
Right.
He's mercurial.
Oh, no, that's right.
He's mercurial. He drinks all the time. He doesn't even understand what he's facing. That is, he thinks, this isn't a real invasion.
Not a real invasion. No. As long as their tank crews are not supported by infantry units, they are merely little flags stuck on a map, because the tank crews cannot support themselves. No, I refuse to see in this spectacular raid of the German tank a real invasion.
He does not understand the speed of the German army, which the Brits were not prepared for.
That's right. He doesn't understand the lack of preparedness of Britain, and he also doesn't understand the extent to which the decisions that were made for appeasement had actually bought Britain some time, but maybe not quite enough time.
The Halifax Chamberlain side is actually powerfully presented, because they think what you have to think, that Britain is about to lose its entire army, right? And the Germans are going to invade Britain, and they are not going to be able to stop them. And if they don't do something, make some concession, they're just a conquered people, right?
That's
so
right.
What do? And they keep saying, look, Churchill, you got to come to terms with this guy. And that's not a silly thought.
No, it's not a silly thought. And there was this huge history of Churchill as being a loose cannon.
Right. I mean, his reputation was not at that point a reputation as a successful leader of war.
There's a nice sequence of scenes in the movie when he's named prime minister. People are whispering in the hallways, oh, he did this, he did that, he did that. Like, this guy's a disaster. But he was right about Hitler.
Yes. If you do believe something about what the role of an individual can be in history, particularly with his use of words and his ability to inspire, Churchill probably made a critical difference to whether Britain fell.
How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased, good God, given him mixed privileges, before we learn you cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth?
So I'm going to make you guys fish or cut bait here. If you had to give a Dionysus Award to one of these two movies, you could say, I'm not going to give it to either, but I want you to justify your choice of Dionysus Award to X, to Y, or to neither. So, Leslie, let's start with you.
So I would give it to Dunkirk precisely for the reason Josh developed a little while ago, the way Dunkirk layers the way war appears in the lives of people at different levels. The ultimate speech and the British people, and suddenly bringing it back into the context of the war that was going to go on.
Okay, so just I want you to give me your best case that Darkest Hour deserves a Dionysus Award.
Okay, one reason I think that Darkest Hour appeals to people in this particular moment is that I think we have a nostalgia, whether mistaken or otherwise, for a time in which there was a strong, charismatic leader who could actually lead the fight against the forces of darkness. And, you know, this is not, well, you don't have to talk about the current situation in this country, but you think about the situation in Britain today around Brexit, it just feels as though there's a complete leadership vacuum. So one of the things I think that Darkest Hour does really well is present a picture of how an individual who's actually not in any way perfect, a deeply flawed individual, can nonetheless rise to the occasion and provide a kind of moral and charismatic, inspiringly moral leadership for a nation that desperately needs it.
I think, you know what? Neither of these movies on its own is like gets it completely right. Dunkirk too decontextualizes it. I mean, it's important. Men at War is important. But men in this war This is really, really important not to lose the context. And The Darkest Hour tries to do this thing about how Churchill connected to the British people, went over the heads of his own party and reached out to the people and drew inspiration from them. But it does it in such a ham-fisted way. These scenes of Churchill driving through the crowds and these people, the British people, going about their thing with determination. And then that absurd underground scene.
Yeah.
That's just absurd. Okay, but here's what you can do on a philosophy movie. You can make the Mariological Sum. Take any two things and combine them, and you'll get a new thing. So I want to give a Dionysus Award for the richest investigation of the drivers of history to the Mariological Sum of Dunkirk and Darkest Hour.
And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or large...
This island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving. And our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British
fleet. And guarded by the British fleet.
And carry on the struggle. Until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might.
With all its power and might. Steps forth to the rescue.
And the liberation of the old.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're taking a philosophical look at the movies of 2017 for our fifth annual Dionysus Awards show.
In our next segment, we'll take nominations from our listeners, and we'll consider last year's sequel to one of the most philosophically satisfying science fiction movies ever made.
Nominations from the floor and so much more when Philosophy Talk continues. It's the fifth, mostly annual, Dionysus Awards. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're talking about the most philosophically compelling movies of 2017.
We're joined now by Jorah Dannenberg, our colleague from the Stanford Philosophy Department. Jorah's been thinking about last year's sequel to one of our favorite philosophical movies of all time, Blade Runner. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk, Jorah.
Thank you very much.
Now, Jorah, I regard the original Blade Runner as perhaps the, or maybe the second best, but at least one of the two best science fiction movies of all time. And in terms of philosophically interesting science fiction, I think it's almost perfect, especially the director's cut. So here's a question.
Yeah.
Could a sequel, sequels usually pale in comparison to the original. Could a sequel possibly live up to that original? Do you think this does?
I think the sequel does a pretty good job of at least getting very close.
So tell us about the core of Blade Runner's philosophy, right? Both the original and the sequel. So what are the questions of the issue?
So here are two things about the first Blade Runner. One, there's this question about mortality and confronting one's own mortality and confronting the rationale for it, in some sense, if there is to be a rationale. And two, there's this question of whether or not empathy is the key to being a human being in the morally important way. In the second movie, in Blade Runner 2049, mortality is replaced by the question of birth and genesis,
right?
So now the kind of driving plot point is that we now learn that at least one of the replicants has been able to reproduce itself, and both the sort of resistance movement among the replicants and the police and the police captain seem to agree that if it gets out that the replicants could replicate themselves, this would be the end of the wall that divides replicant and human.
Anything else?
I burned everything else.
Then what's this? What's that date? Is that a birthday? Is that a death day?
I don't know yet.
Am I the only one that can see the sunrise here? This breaks the world, Kay.
It sounds like this movie is to the earlier Blade Runner as Hannah Arendt is to Heidegger, right? So it's replacing mortality with natality.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And here's the second thing that's different. Instead of empathy, it's free will.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the test in the second film in Blade Runner 2049 seems to be a test for something like the capacity for freedom. And in fact, the thing that now makes it okay to have the replicants around is supposedly that they've been made obedient. That is, their capacity for free choice or some aspect of their capacity for free choice has been taken away. Now, I happen to think if you watch the film closely at all, this doesn't hold up.
No, it doesn't at all.
The replicants, in fact, it's one of the ways in which it's remarkable is that the replicants lie to their superiors.
Yeah, but right? I want to go back to the birth thing because I think this is really important because now the replicants aren't just replicated, but they can replicate themselves. They're self-replicating. And now, because they can form a collectivity, they're like a people that potentially has a history. They're not just added by the whim of somebody else. They grow themselves like a human community, and they can become not just a rebellious force, like, oh, the machines are turning against us, but like a people turning against their oppressors and the people. And one can sacrifice themselves for the greater good of the species that they know have reason to believe it continue. And that changes their whole moral frame, I think.
The ancient models give the entire endeavor a bad name. What a gift, don't you think? From Mr. Wallace to the world. The outer colonies would never have flourished had he not bought Tyrell, revivified the technology. To say the least of what we do.
So this was a great year for film 2017. So we had, among other things, Blade Runner 2049 and The Shape of Water. And both of these movies ask the question, what it is to be a human, as opposed to a replicant or as opposed to a monster. Is it about language use? Is it about the capacity for morality? Do you think there's something about the present moment that is causing people to ask this question in these beautiful, powerful, pointed ways that those two movies are doing?
I think there's this demand to ask what, if anything, could justify treating certain beings in ways that make them systematically subordinate.
Right.
And part of the power of the film, I think especially 2049, is that there's at least one character in the film who suggests that the answer to this is that there's no real justification for it. It's just something that we will find a way to do if we need to do it.
Did it never occur to you that's why you were summoned in the first place? Designed to do nothing short of fall for her right then and there. All to make that single, perfect specimen. That is, if you were designed.
But I think there's something deeper, though. You know, slavery would be a really nice thing if you could design a person, a creature, that had all these human-like capacities, but was willing to be slave. I think all these kinds of movies, not The Shape of Water, but all these kind of robot, android, they all are asking themselves, okay, in the total package of capacities that humans have, how could we get, like, just enough of the package that they were agents and they could do all these things and they could reason, but they would not have this moral considerability.
I guess Get Out falls into that category, too.
Yeah, how could we get just enough of that package, right? And I think most of these movies are telling us, you know what, as we get further and further advanced with our AI and all this sort of stuff and bioengineering, we're going to come right up against that question. Yeah. And the hopeful answer is no, there's, you know, if you get some of the package, you're going to get all of the package. The dystopian answer is, yeah, there's a way to do this, but you know, you may not find the precise borderline. So.
Well, there's a way in which actually I want to suggest that there's a different dystopian answer. No, it all comes as a package, but human beings are very good at blinding themselves to the way in which the very thing that might make someone suitable as a slave also makes them deserving of better treatment.
Right.
And so we find ways to justify the treatment or other ways to blind ourselves to the way in which these things are coming as a package.
Okay, so Josh, it's time to fish or cut bait. It's time to decide whether we're going to give Blade Runner 2049 a Dionysus Award for being the best something of 2017. But here's my own standard. It has to justify itself on its own merit. It doesn't get to bask in the glory of its father.
Yeah, I mean, look, this one is a little slower and, you know, perhaps has a couple of flaws, but it's beautiful. And this movie is doing something different from the original. Right, it's taking the stakes of the original movie and raising them. And so, yeah, I'm going to say, yes, this is worthy of a Dionysus Award.
So, the 2017 Dionysus Award for the best, not necessarily needed, but still deserving science fiction philosophical movie goes to
Blade Runner 2049.
Why? What am I to you?
Go meet your daughter.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk's Dionysus Awards for the most philosophically compelling movies of 2017.
And it's time for nominations from the floor. Son in Palo Alto, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So what's your nomination from the floor?
So I'm nominating Star Wars The Last Jedi, the recent Star Wars movie. You might be a little bit skeptical, but the whole concept of actually the way, the Jedi way, actually does come from Taoist philosophy. So in Taoism, there's the yin and the yang, and those create a balance in the world, the dark and the light side. They're not necessarily evil and good because they're considered to be important. But anyway, the intricate balance is very important.
I've always been curious about this in Star Wars because on the one hand, I agree with you, and I think that's one of the subtleties of Star Wars. The governing premise is supposed to be, in fact, you need a balance between light side and dark side. On the other hand, the movies seem to be about the necessity for the light side, so to speak, to defeat the dark side. So is this just an inconsistency?
No. I think the power in the universe, the force is somehow the fundamental power in the universe. The Jedi know how to channel this power. But one lives on the knife's edge, right? When one gets this power, one gets great power, and one gets in touch with something really deep and fundamental that binds all things together, and the ability to do whatever they do with the force, be guided by it, manipulate it. They live on the knife's edge because you notice that almost everybody who tries to train some Jedi fails. Luke fails, right?
Yoda failed too, yeah.
Yeah, Yoda fails. I mean, they fail because really, really hard.
This is not going to go the way you think.
Kylo failed you. I won't.
But here's my question for you, son. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of these Star Wars movies, and there's one that I really admire. That's The Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, I think in comparison to The Empire Strikes Back, this is kind of like a retelling because the rebel forces are scattered and there's this division. But it just seems to me it doesn't even measure up to its own predecessor.
So one of the tropes I think that was consistent throughout the franchise but maybe not really followed through in this movie is kind of the very clear line between the good and the bad. Most of the characters, the good guys are good because they're able to not be tempted into going to the dark side, right? But in this movie, I think it's a little bit different because, well, first of all, Snoke, the evil Sith Lord, he dies like midway in the movie and people are shocked. And I think this was actually an active choice by the filmmakers to indicate that they were really getting away from having that character who is the symbol of all evil. I think they want to show that perhaps with Kylo Ren that evil wasn't that simple. Realistic evil was definitely just a mixture of evil and good, and you have hope that perhaps Kylo Ren is also good, and he's definitely more relatable. He has these vulnerabilities that we don't see in Sith Lords, because they seem like, oh my god, they got everything together. They are just pure evil. We also have Rey, the main character, and she, in that kind of weird kind of dream that she experiences, she literally just goes straight into the dark side.
What do you see?
Light. Darkness. And something else.
But Rey isn't like the conventional good characters who are never tempted into dark side. She literally flirts with the dark side by having that weird connection with Kylo Ren, right? And so again, we have two characters, Kylo Ren and Rey, who are lingering in some boundary and do not show themselves to be either at the very edge of the spectrum.
I agree with you. I think it's a really interesting feature of this movie and a departure from the previous installments in this franchise that it's more morally complex. But I also think there's a really interesting question it raises about whether we even want Jedi in the first place. Where is progressive action really going to come from? Is it going to come from these charismatic elite figures who have special powers? Or is it going to come from the grassroots? Is it going to come from people like Rey? You know, Rey, of course, gets some training, but Do we even want Jedi?
But see, that's a continuing trope. Because Luke Skywalker, he has the Force is power. Darth Vader says, the Force is powerful within you, Luke, but you are not a Jedi yet. Right. And so the recurring thing throughout the franchise is that, you know, the path to the full Jedi-ness is long and hard. And everybody wants to take a shortcut. And the thing that puts Luke Skywalker in danger is that he wants to take a shortcut. And you're right, son, that Rey flirts with the dark side. That may be, I mean, the franchise philosophy would say that may be her undoing. She doesn't have the discipline to follow the long, slow, torturous path of becoming a full Jedi. Maybe. So I don't know. I do agree it's a more morally complicated universe. In Star Wars, The Last Jedi, I do agree it's more morally complicated. I don't know. It still seems to me it's so much of a retelling. And you are convincing me that there's more added elements, son, than there were in the original Star Wars. But I would have never given the original Star Wars, not even The Empire Strikes Back, if we were doing Dionysus Awards back in the day. I would have never given it a Dionysus Award. So it's got.
I would have.
You would have?
Yeah, I would have.
Okay, I've got an idea. The Dionysus Award for the best Star Wars movie of 2017 goes to
Star Wars The Last Jedi.
Yay.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling in, son.
Okay,
bye-bye.
If you've got a Dionysus-worthy movie from 2017 that wasn't discussed on today's show and maybe wasn't featured on one of those alternative awards shows, we'd love to hear from you. Send your nominees to comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.